Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast. Check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. Speaking of podcasts, when this releases, the new Outlaw God podcast will be out. It actually comes out the day that we're recording this. So for sure, it's going to be out by the time you're listening to this. So if you haven't subscribed to the Outlaw God podcast with Stephen Paulson, you should do that. Give it a listen. See if that's something that interests you. It interests me. It interests Chad. So, I mean, just type in Outlaw God into whatever podcast app you use. Chad, what's going on, man?
Well, gradually, day by day, week by week, getting back to something close to normal life.
There you go.
My wife's back to work full time, so it's quiet here at the house, and everything else is, at least in Texas anyway, everything else is kind of getting back to normal. But everything going well? Your neck of the woods?
Everything's all right, man. We were just talking before this, right before I came, we started recording. I went and got a COVID test. Don't worry, I don't have any COVID symptoms. Just had to get one because I had a doctor's visit, and then they had to do a COVID test before I could go. So got that. It's not the greatest thing ever. Feels like they're scrubbing your brain when they stick that thing in your nose.
But, besides that, it's quite enjoyable.
Yeah, it's great. It feels like it's kind of like getting punched in the nose a little bit as far as the after effects. You feel like a baby. Your eyes are watering uncontrollably. So I'm just saying, if you haven't got one, it's an experience.
Yeah, sounds like it. Yeah. Oh, fun times.
Yeah, but I was able to get through it because I knew we were starting a brand new book. I had to get through it so I could get back here and get this thing fired up because we're in Ruth chapter 1 today.
I know. Yeah, it felt good. I started preparing this morning, looking over some of the material that I had gathered together, and I was like, man, this is like, you know, coming out of a really nasty, dark cave into some sunlight.
Yeah, and this is a thing.
It's a huge change.
You know, Judges is dark when you start looking at the first chapter of Ruth and think, well, this is better when it's all about multiple deaths. And
right, yeah. Famine, all these people dying. You're like, yeah, but it's not as bad as Judges.
Yeah, at least they're not murdering entire civilizations and you know, kidnapping virgins, and at least that's not happening.
You know, you look at almost all the characters in Ruth and you're like, you know what? These are, at least from what we know about them from the story, they're pretty decent people.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. I'm not saying they're perfect, of course, but nobody's going out like, you know, slaughtering a bunch of people or raping or pillaging or any of that other stuff that we at least covered in the last few chapters of Judges. So yeah, I mean, everyone in here, they had kind of you get to a feel for their unique personalities, and yeah, they seem like they'd be pretty decent neighbors to have if, you know, falling on some hard times. But that's kind of the story of Ruth. I mean, one of the main themes of Ruth, as we'll see, is this move from emptiness to fullness.
Yeah.
And, you know, you have the theme of divine providence too, which of course, I mean, that you could say that of any of the biblical books, but it really emerges as a pretty major theme here. Because God is mentioned. It's not like in Esther where, you know, mention of God is basically just nil. God is mentioned, but he's kind of like, it's kind of like the Joseph narrative when we're back in Genesis. There's not a whole lot of God talk in the Joseph narrative, but you can just see, of course, how between the lines, behind the scenes, the divine hand of providence is just working things out, putting Joseph exactly where he wants him to be so that he eventually will end up at the right hand of Pharaoh. It's kind of like this here. I mean, you start out, as we already mentioned, where it's like, you know, you got a famine, you got a husband dying, a husband and father dying, you got these two sons dying, and now you have a widow and have these two daughters-in-law that are widows as well. You know, what's gonna happen here? But you can see immediately after that how providence is kind of working to manipulate events to place people where he wants them to be. So I mean, you got that.
Ruth is a lot of ways like the ultimate Old Testament story of God working all things together for good.
Yeah, it is. It's kind of a Romans 8:28 kind of book for sure. I mean, if you were preaching on that text and be like, what'd be a good Old Testament story I could use as illustrative of this? Well, here you go. That's what Ruth is all about.
Yeah, and Ruth, and so Ruth takes place in the time of the judges, but it's a little bit hard to place it, right? I mean, we don't know exactly. We just went through the entire book of Judges. This is taking place at some point during that. Not sure exactly where this would slide in. And also, as we discovered as we were through Judges, Judges isn't exactly chronological either.
Yeah, that's exactly right. We, especially in that last really terrible story that we read about, that probably happened early, a lot earlier than a lot of the other events in Judges. And as I think we mentioned sometime when we were covering the various judges, you know, some of these probably overlap too. So we kind of sometimes get the impression, okay, you had this judge, then you had this period of rest, and you had that judge and this period of rest. Well, most of the judges were more local. You know, they were working with this tribe or these couple of tribes. You didn't really have like a judge who was traveling all around delivering, you know, this tribe and that tribe. Most of them just were in one small area. So you could have had, for instance, a judge in the southern part of the 12 tribes, and you could have had another judge who was doing his thing at the same time in the northern parts of the tribe. So yeah, there's not a lot of real strict chronology there. So it's like that with Ruth. We don't know when it happened. We do know, of course, from the opening words that it does take place during the time of the judges, because that's the way it starts out. Now, it came about in the days when the judges governed, literally when the judges judged. So that's the reason that it's placed where it's at least in our English Bibles. So it follows Judges because of the chronology. It also follows it because in some of the older translations, like the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible, it's the order of the books follows this particular order that we have in the English, or the English follows that particular order. So Ruth follows Judges in the Septuagint. Now, it's not like that in a lot of the Hebrew manuscripts, which is kind of interesting. So you kind of have two different placements. The Ruth is considered in most Hebrew Bibles to be part of what's called the five megaloth. Megaloth just means scrolls. So you have these five scrolls or five megaloth. And these are shorter books. These are books like Esther and Song of Songs and Ruth and Lamentations. And each of these five scrolls or five megaloth were associated with different Jewish festivals. So for instance, every year, and I guess they still do this in Jewish synagogues. So every year on the festival of Passover, they read Song of Songs. And then every year on the festival of Shavuot, which we call Pentecost, is when they read Ruth. And sometimes you can kind of figure out why theologically. I think the reason that Ruth is placed at Pentecost is because a lot of it has to do with harvest, of course. And that's what Pentecost historically was all about. It was a celebration of the grain harvest. So it kind of makes sense to read Ruth at that particular festival. Anyway, Ruth was part of these five scrolls or the five megaloth. And sometimes I find this particularly appropriate that in some of the Hebrew manuscripts, so Ruth would have been placed immediately after Proverbs. Now, what's the end of Proverbs? Proverbs 31, you have that section about the noble woman. And then that would immediately been followed by the book of Ruth. So it's very very appropriate joining of those two together. But anyway, it's part of an addendum, we might call it, to the book of Judges. And a great way really to end our time of spending with the judges on a very positive note, with this kind of a short story or novella or whatever you want to call it. You know, before we jump in, one thing that's very interesting, and you pick up on this pretty quickly in the story, Ruth is different than a lot of biblical books because a lot of the story is told by means of dialogue. I was looking at a commentary this morning, and he says that if you count up just the words, so there's 1,294 Hebrew words in this book. Well, of those 1,294, 678 of them are words that are spoken by the characters. So that it comes out to about 52% of the book is dialogue. That's pretty unique in biblical storytelling. Most of the time you just have narrative. I mean, you have dialogue too, but that's one of the things that sets the book of Ruth apart, is that it's composed, over half of the book is composed of kind of this back and forth. And say this one more thing before we jump into it. It's called Ruth, which is the only book in the Old Testament that is named after a non-Israelite. But the name itself is debatable as to whether it would be the best thing to call it, because as you're reading through the story, I mean, Ruth is a central character. Don't get me wrong. But I think the book is more about Naomi than it is Ruth. Or you can maybe even make an argument that it's more about Boaz than it is about Ruth. But Ruth is a title that was chosen, which is pretty cool, because this is a non-Israelite who gets her name chosen to be beyond this Old Testament book. Okay, well, that's enough preliminary stuff. We'll jump in here and see how much we can cover in our remaining time. Start out here, just kind of setting the context, read these first few verses. Now, it came about in the days when the judges governed that there was a famine in the land. And a certain man of Bethlehem in Judah went to sojourn in the land of Moab with his wife and his two sons. And the name of the man was Elimelech, and the name of his wife Naomi. And the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion, Ephrathites of Bethlehem in Judah. Now they entered the land of Moab and remained there. Then Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left with her two sons. And they took for themselves Moabite women as wives. The name of the one was Orpah, and the name of the other, Ruth. And they lived there about 10 years. Then Mahlon and Chilion also died, and the woman was bereft of her two children and her husband. Now, right away, there's some language that's introduced here, which is going to be picked up. It's going to be picked up later on. And there's also some language here that kind of sends us backward in time so that we can make some connections and some expectations based upon what was said here in these opening verses. One of these is in the very first verse. It says that there was a famine in the land. Interestingly, that Hebrew phrase for there was a famine, that particular Hebrew phrase is only found in two places, and they're both in the book of Judges, and they're both in the patriarchal narratives about, for instance, when there was a famine in the days of Abraham, and then later there's a famine in the days of Isaac. Now, the reason this is significant is because, okay, if you know your Bible, you know, you're a podcast listener, you know what happened in Genesis, and you're thinking, okay, so, and say you didn't know anything about the book of Ruth, you're thinking, all right, well, this is going to work out well because, you know, there was a famine in the days of Abraham, and he went down into Egypt, and yeah, he got into trouble there, but look, when he came back after the famine was over, he was rich, right? I mean, he left on this exile because of famine, but when he returned full. He returned rich. He had all this stuff that he didn't have when he left. So maybe when you're reading these opening words of the book of Ruth, you're thinking, oh, okay, well, you know, there's a famine. All right, they're going to leave. They're going to go not to Egypt. They're going to go to Moab. But everything's going to be okay because when they come back, they're going to come back full. This is one of those expectations that's kind of built into the narrative that ends up leading to a surprise and disappointment. Because as we will see later on, Ruth or Naomi does not come back full. She comes back, in her own words, exactly the opposite, that she left full and then she came back empty. So things are not going to be simply a replica of the patriarchal story. There's going to be a surprise here. And another thing that jumped out at me in verse one is that this is another Bethlehem story. I hadn't really thought about that until this morning. So in the last two main stories of Judges, both of those had things happening to them or people in these stories that were connected with Bethlehem. So this is like the third Bethlehem story in a row. The first Bethlehem story in the book of Judges, I think it was chapter 17, was where you had that Levite for hire. Remember the guy that, you know, he was a Levite from Bethlehem and he's traveling around. He's basically looking for a patron who's going to hire him to serve at his private sanctuary, and he finds that guy. So that guy, that Levite, was from Bethlehem. That didn't go so well. And then the second story, the last story of the book of Judges, the concubine who ended up being murdered, gang raped, murdered, cut up into 12 pieces, she was from Bethlehem. Well, now we have another Bethlehem story. Of course, this one is going to be a much different kind of story, but I do find that interesting, just the way this is all set up canonically. You got three Bethlehem stories in a row, two very bad stories, and then this one, in which you're going to have this light of hope and dawn beginning to emerge. Now, they end up, as I was reading, they end up going to Moab. Now, that if you're familiar with everything that went before this, you're thinking, man, Moab, that's not a very safe place for an Israelite to end up. Because, first of all, Moab has this pretty sketchy history. You know, if you remember what happened after the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, Moab is a result of the incestuous union between Lot and one of his daughters. So that's where the nation came from, not a real heritage that you want to boast over. And then when the Israelites were journeying through the wilderness, the Moabites were against them. And you remember the whole terrible incident where the Moabite women were, I don't want to say they were seducing the Israelite men, because that makes it sound like it was the fault of the Moabite women. I suspect this was a two-way relationship. Anyway, let's just say the Moabite women and the Israelite men were hooking up, and they weren't supposed to. And this led to this, you know, huge massacre and plague. It was a terrible, terrible incident in the life of Israel's past. But that's where these Israelites are going. So they're going to Moab, and these two sons end up taking two Moabite women, which was, strictly speaking, was forbidden by the Torah. But I suppose, you know, you're there 10 years and the boys aren't getting any younger. And so I guess mom and dad were like, well, you know, we're here and you need to marry, and we're not going to go back to Bethlehem, so you can, you know, marry somebody from your family tree. So I guess you're going to marry some Moabite women instead. Well, what happens is they escape famine and they run right into the jaws of death. So Naomi's husband, Elimelech, dies. And then it says that either her two sons died at different times, or the language there is possible that they actually died together. Who knows? It might've been some accident, or we're not told what happened. But once we get to the fifth verse, we know that Naomi's in a situation where she's basically bereft of everything. She left full. She left with her husband. She had two sons, and no doubt they thought they might have a future and a hope in Moab. But it turns out that everything that happened to them was not what they expected. And so now she's in that situation where, you know, we've all been at one time or another, of course, probably not exactly like Naomi, but man, you have high hopes and you're thinking, this is the best choice that you can make. Maybe it's a move. Maybe it's a new relationship. Maybe it's a new job, whatever. And then everything just kind of begins to crumble around you. And before you know it, it's just like one thing after another hits. And you're left like Naomi is here, thinking that basically your life is over. I mean, of course, we haven't gotten to that yet. It's verses 6 and following, but you can really empathize with Naomi if you've been in that situation before, you know, where she's like, don't even call me Naomi, call me Mara, call me bitter, because the Lord has dealt very bitterly with me. And she just really, she's struggling with trying to make sense of a life in which she, as a believer, is suffering through all of this pain and loss and heartache. And that's a really, really tough place to be.
And this is a extremely desperate situation to be in this time, for your husband to die and your two sons to die. Now you've got an older woman and two younger women, and they've got nobody. That would be pretty tragic. Now, it puts you in a real bad situation then.
Yeah. It's tragic on a whole other level then, because, you know, there's no, as we talked about before with the widows, there's no social net to catch you. You know, there's really nothing you can rely on except your family, and she's not with her family. That's, you know, that's one of the reasons she goes back, I'm sure. She hears that God has blessed Bethlehem with food again, so she goes back. But she's not among her people. It's not like she became a Moabite when she was there. And now I'm sure she feels responsible for these two daughters-in-law. You know, what are they going to do? And then you kind of, even though it's not really, it's not brought out here explicitly, but you also have the kind of the patriarchal theme of barrenness, right? Mm-hmm. Because we don't know how long they were married, but we do know they were in the land for 10 years. So I'm assuming that they were married for, quite a few of those years, and there are no children. So you've got kind of that in the background as well. There's just a lot going on with Naomi that helps to explain why she speaks the way she does, why she makes the decisions that she does. And we get to where, you know, we can't help but feel sorry for everything that she's not only gone through, but probably will go through into the future. So verse 6, what's she going to do? It says she arose with her daughters-in-law that she might return from the land of Moab. So she's returning from exile. She's going home. Why? Because she heard in the land of Moab that the Lord had visited his people in giving them food. So it's kind of an irony built into this story too. Bethlehem, as most people know, comes from two Hebrew words, Beit Lechem, which means house of bread. And the house of bread was where there was a famine, not what you would expect, but that's what happened. And now she hears basically that God has, as it were, restocked the shelves of the house of bread. So there's once more, there is the blessing of good crops in Bethlehem. So of course she goes home. And there's also the introduction here of the idea of God actively working to bless his people. It says the Lord had visited his people. So how did he visit them? Well, he visited them specifically in giving them once more rain and fruitful crops. And so she decides it's time to go home. There's nothing really keeping her in Moab as well. So
this seems, coming out of Judges, if you start thinking about, okay, so there was this span of quite a while, many years, where you got a famine in Bethlehem. Okay. And then it seems as though, like, almost as though, like, God has been like, yeah, hands off. And then she hears that, oh, looks like God has visited his people again. I mean, if this is not the theme of Judges, I don't know what is. It's not, if you put yourself back in Judges, it's not hard to imagine, like, well, I wonder what could be going on all these years. That God has sort of taken his hand off of his people. Well, this is probably doing what was right in their own eyes. Probably got famine. Probably got, oppression. All this stuff. This works in concert with Judges pretty well.
Yeah, it does. It does. I mean, if you go back and read the ending of Leviticus and Deuteronomy, I think it's Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28. That's where you have the whole list of covenant blessings and curses. One of the curses that God threatens to level against Israel should they rebel against the Torah is, I think the exact language is something like, he will make the heavens as bronze and the earth as iron. In other words, there ain't gonna be nothing coming down from above and there's nothing growing below. So drought, famine, lack of food, all of that kind of fits in with the covenantal curses. And yeah, that also fits in with what was happening in the book of Judges, where you have God kind of letting the people figure out that when they have their own way, when they do what's right in their own eyes, it does not turn out well. You know, we are the worst at solving our own problems, humanity, that is, because we typically end up making things a whole lot worse. Because, yeah, we're doing whatever we think is right, whatever is right in our own eyes. And 9 times out of 10, that is not what is right in the eyes of God.
Yep.
Okay, so she departs from the place where she was, and she takes it. It seems at first like, I kind of get the picture like all three are starting out on this journey, right? Because it says that she departs from her place where she was and her two daughters-in-law with her. So I don't know if, like, you know, we're kind of starting out on this journey together, and they're heading back to the land of Judah. And then all of a sudden, Naomi stops, and it's like she's finally come to a decision. I don't know, but that's kind of the impression that I get from this.
Maybe they were they traveled a certain distance and they were nearer to these girls' hometown.
Yeah, that's always possible too, yeah. Right? And she's like, and then
this is where you stop.
This is where you stop. Yeah, this is where Naomi adopts a kind of a tough love posture, right? She says, picking up with verse 8, she says to the two of them, "Go, return each of you to your mother's house. May the Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me. May the Lord grant that you may find rest each in the house of her husband." And then she kissed them and they lifted up their voices and wept. And they said to her, so they both said to her, "No, but we will surely return with you to your people." But Naomi said, "Return, my daughters. Why should you go with me? Have I yet sons in my womb that they may be your husbands? Return, my daughters, go, for I am too old to have a husband. And if I said I have hope, if I should even have a husband tonight and also bear sons, would you therefore wait until they were grown? Would you therefore refrain from marrying? No, my daughters, for it is harder for me," or that could be translated, "more bitter for me than for you. For the hand of the Lord has gone forth against me." And they lifted up their voices and wept again. And Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her. So this is basically Naomi freeing them from any kind of commitment that they thought they needed to have with her so that they could go back home and basically start their lives over again. She's saying, "Look, I have nothing to offer you. I mean, it's not like I have other sons that you can marry." And then she kind of gives this, you know, crazy scenario, like, "Listen, you know, what if I get married tonight and I conceive twins? I have two sons in my womb and they're born. Oh, what are you going to do? You know, wait 18 years
yeah.
to marry them?" In other words, she's like pushing the envelope here with the example, but she's basically saying, "Look, I have zero to offer you. There's nothing that I can do for you. The best thing, you're both presumably still young. So just go back home, go back to your parents' house and find some good men and remarry and start a family over with them, because there's nothing that I can offer you for the future that's going to provide any kind of hope for you." And it's interesting the way she ends this, because she says, "No, my daughters, for it is harder," or as I said, "more bitter for me than for you. Because," and I think this is significant to kind of get into the Israelite mindset. She says, she doesn't say, "Because all of this misfortune has befallen me," or she doesn't say, "Because we've had just this terrible string of bad luck," or "The universe has turned against us," you know,
yeah,
in typical Israelite fashion,
or even just the practical part. It's more bitter for me than it is for you, because you lost husbands, I lost a husband and sons. So
right,
on the bitterness scale, I've got a lot.
Got a lot more. No, she says, I would paraphrase this. It says for the hand of the Lord has gone forth against me. I would paraphrase this as, "Because God has attacked me." The Hebrew phrase there that I mean, this idea in Hebrew of like a hand being against you, that's pretty common. But usually the way this works in Hebrew is, Jill, that the hand will just be like against someone or in front of someone, kind of like, you know, kind of like holding them back. Maybe if, you know, I'm trying to prevent someone from going somewhere and I stand in front of them, I put my hands against them and hold them back. That's one thing. It's quite another thing if I'm trying to prevent them from going somewhere and I hit him in the face. That's the image it uses here. When it says the hand of the Lord has gone forth against me, this is the image of striking, of attacking. So Naomi is using kind of a superlative here. I mean, the image that she is going for here is not that of kind of this soft standing against someone, but she is picturing God as someone who has actually attacked her, actively gone against her.
I suppose it's possible. I mean, it's not in the text, but as you were saying, Moab is a strange place for them to go in the first place. And as she heads back, obviously because she hears that the famine has ended in Bethlehem, But one of the reasons certainly that she could be thinking this is that, man, God really is, was really displeased with us going to Moab, marrying, you know, marrying our sons off to these Moabite women. There are things in the text that if you feel like God is against you, that you could point to and say, well, it's probably this and this and this. Now, I'm not saying that that is the case. I don't, that, that is certainly not right. The case, but it would be easy to deduce that.
Yes, it would. It would. Yeah. I always, when I talk at churches or conferences about lament, I almost always go to Ruth chapter 1 and talk about Naomi. And the reason is because she really does give voice to the typical Israelite way of expressing, well, frustration is too mild a word, but we'll just say of expressing lament for the way that things are. You know, and she speaks in a way that I don't think that we are entirely comfortable with, at least a lot of people aren't comfortable with. I mean, when someone says to us, you know, God has turned against me, or God has, the hand of the Lord has gone forth against me, that makes a lot of people very uncomfortable. But that just happens to be the way that a lot of the Psalms speak. They are very blunt when they describe how God has turned against them, or God is asleep, or whatever it might be. Now, that might make us uncomfortable, but that is the biblical way of talking, because it's simply an honest expression of what the person is going through. They don't believe that God is somehow absent and maybe watching from a distance and sort of a hands-off kind of deity, just kind of letting the situation play out the way that it might. They see him as active in all things. And so it's not unusual for them to attribute things that we might attribute just to chance or to fate or to just evil in the world even. It's not unusual for them to attribute that directly to God. That's what Naomi does here. Well, what's going to happen? They're evidently all three of these women are evidently extremely close to each other. They've gone through so much. We don't know if the daughters-in-law were around when Naomi's husband died, but anyway, they've grieved with her. They've experienced her widowhood, and then they themselves experienced widowhood. So all of these just terrible emotional experiences have welded these three women together. And so naturally, when they're about to part, there's crying, lifting up of their voices, so a kind of wailing there. It's an extremely emotional scene here. But it says, Orpah kissed her mother-in-law goodbye, but Ruth did not. Ruth clung to her. The Hebrew verb behind that word for clung is davak. It's the word that is used a lot of times in the scriptures, but the first time we encounter it is when in Genesis chapter 2, where it says a man will leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife. It's the idea of being glued to another one, bonded to someone else. It can be used positively, it can be used negatively, but it is this idea of something holding on to another one, sticking to another one. And so that's what Ruth is doing here. She's davaking, she's cleaving to her mother-in-law.
I will say this, before we get into the great words of Ruth, which are great, and we should, like, we, I mean, they are worth extolling. One of the things that bothers me when I hear people go through Ruth is that they'll make this division between Orpah and Ruth, as if Ruth did the right thing and that Orpah did some kind of evil here. I mean, I even heard a guy say once that when talking about this passage, that in this situation that Orpah, you know, kisses her mother-in-law and Ruth clings to her, and this is the difference between Judas and John.
Oh, seriously?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, goodness.
Now, and it's, you know, be a Ruth, don't be an Orpah kind of thing, right?
Yeah.
I don't think Orpah does anything wrong here.
No, I don't think that she does either.
No. In fact, God's got a certain somebody in mind for Ruth that's going to work all this out. We don't have any reason to believe that there's like a second Boaz out there, you know. I think this goes exactly, I mean, if you want to talk about providence, I think this goes exactly the way that God desires it to go, and that we shouldn't, while rightfully extolling Ruth for the words that she's about to say, which are great words, and great words for the church. And I don't think that you have to then say it because Ruth does this incredible thing, and says these beautiful words, this somehow means that Orpah did something wrong. I don't think she did. I mean, she just listened to her mother-in-law.
Yeah, you can't. Yeah, there's nothing in the text to suggest that we should vilify her.
Yeah, so this be a Ruth, don't be an Orpah thing, I think you can toss that out.
Yeah, definitely can. I mean, yeah, she's just doing what her mother-in-law asked her to do.
Yeah, and comparing her to Judas is absurd.
Oh, yeah, that's like, it's no excuse for that whatsoever. No. There's no betrayal here,
no.
Right? There's nothing here whatsoever that suggests that Orpah is somehow betraying Ruth. She's actually obeying her mother-in-law, right?
Yes.
She's doing exactly what she asked her to do. Now, Ruth is different, which is great. But as you say, God in his providence, he had plans for Orpah, and who knows, you know? If she married an Israelite man, I would assume that she was exposed to the Israelite faith. So who knows what good she might have done when she returned to her own land and took that faith along with her.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. We can get into the words. I've just heard this numerous times and wanted to.
Orpah needed a little bit of defense.
Yeah. I'm like come on.
Too many times.
Come on, man.
Yeah. Just please never, ever compare her to Judas. There's just no comparison there whatsoever. Okay. So what's Ruth going to do? Well, Ruth says, don't urge me to leave you or turn back from following you, for where you go, I will go, and where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. Thus may the Lord do to me. By the way, that's the only place in Ruth where the name of Yahweh is on the lips of Ruth. Thus may Yahweh, the Lord, do to me, and worse, if anything but death parts you and me. And when Naomi saw that Ruth was determined to go with her, she said no more to her. Yeah, this is a great text. I mean, this is a famous wedding text, of course. If you're a fan of James Avery Jewelry, Texas jeweler, you can buy a ring with these Hebrew words inscribed on it. I mean, it really is. It's one of the most beautiful expressions of a total commitment to another person that you will find in the scriptures. Because Ruth is basically, this is Ruth actively doing what in Hebrew is called chesed, right? This is her showing chesed, love, mercy, self-sacrifice, all of those things that are built into chesed. This is her showing that to her mother-in-law, because she is going to be the one who basically, well, she doesn't stand in the place of her sons and her lost husband, but she is like the one surviving family member that is going to stick with Naomi through whatever comes. She's basically saying that I'm leaving behind my life, everything that defined who I was in the past, so that I can be where you are to my dying day.
Yeah, there's a fearlessness to that sort of commitment that is admirable for sure, because there's not a lot of practically good reasons to do this. You know, if Ruth was an Israelite, it would still be an amazing statement. The fact that she's not and she's going to go with Naomi to Bethlehem is fairly incredible. There really isn't. She has no reason to think that there's much there for her.
No, she could not have been doing this out of like selfish interest, because
no.
You're exactly right. I mean, everything, like if we'd have been talking to her, if we kind of knew the situation and we're looking at things just on a practical level, I probably would have told Ruth, listen, go back home. I mean, I know you're a widow, but you're young, you know, go back to the land that you know and your family and find another husband.
Yeah.
There's no reason for you to, no seemingly rational reason for you to simply leave everything behind and go with Naomi.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the reasons this is often referred to as kind of a almost a disciple kind of move, right? Mm-hmm. Like Jesus' disciples, they leave the nets and left everything behind, and they just follow Christ. And in many ways, that's what's happening here with Ruth and Naomi.
Yeah, I mean, it's one thing for Naomi and her husband to take their sons and move to Moab. They grow up, and then they take Moabite wives. There's no reason to think this is going to work in the opposite direction, that you're going to go, mm-hmm. that some Moabite woman is going to go move into Bethlehem and dudes are going to be lining up. Like, that, it doesn't work in that way. Like, they're not, mm-hmm. there's no reason to think that this is going to happen. You are at least potentially consigning yourself to widowdom from this point on.
Yeah. 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 That's exactly. And that's, anyone who kind of didn't know, you know, the rest of the story, how this unfolds, would assume that would be what was going to happen. You know, just have a case of these two women who Naomi's probably so old, she's not going to remarry. And then Ruth, she's not going to find an eligible bachelor in an Israelite town. I mean, not with the heritage between the bad blood between Israel and Moab, that's just not going to happen. That's what, looking at it from a purely human perspective, we would expect. And that's kind of the way this is set up, the way it is.
Yeah.
So it's going to show.
Well, so it's a lot more than I'll go on this journey with you. I guess that's what I'm saying. It's not that. It's I'm going to live the rest of my life with you.
Yeah. 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 This isn't like two people living in Dallas saying, you know what, you're moving to Denver, I'm moving with you.
No.
No, this is much more extreme than that. So it's setting us up for what, of course, we're going to get to in the next episode, where we begin to see how all these kind of puzzle pieces are gradually, in unexpected sorts of ways, going to start coming together into this composite picture. So stay tuned.
All right. Yep. That is it, guys. Hey, if you like the podcast, you could rate and review it over on iTunes. That helps us out, makes it more visible. And also, if you'd like to become a contributor, you can help support the podcast by going to 1517.org and then go to the donate page and you can become a contributor. Thank you so much to those of you who do that. Chad, I will see you next week.
All right, we'll see you.